It was a mind blower for me, because now instead of working at this big company with all these resources and a secretary and people, it was kind of me and my kitchen table.
Sort of like us right now.
Okay.
Hey, it's EB Moss, and this is episode 1 of Insider Interviews. Now, if you're going to do a podcast about media, marketing, advertising, I think you start where podcasting really began, which is audio, which is radio in my book. So who better to talk to kick it off than Gary Krantz? Gary is an internationally recognized business strategist on content syndication and tech services, primarily in the radio and audio space. He's worked with brands like the Country Music Association, the Grammy Awards Radio Network, names like Ryan Seacrest and Carson Daly. He's been chief digital media officer for Westwood One, the president of Air America Radio, and EVP at Clear Channel, which is now iHeartMedia. Anyway, last year, he also launched a full-service podcast studio, which already includes names like Clay Aikens as the host of the Politicon podcast and Peter Greenberg's Eye on Travel, along with a few others. Gary's the past president of the Country Radio Broadcasters, and he works with New York City's Summer Stage Concert Series. He also plays mandolin and ukulele, but I don't think they've ever brought him up on stage for that. He does have a lot of great stories about big names and big brands in radio and now digital audio. So here's Gary. I can't believe it. This is actually my first episode of Insider Interviews with EB Moss. That would be me. And I have the perfect person for my first episode. It's Gary Krantz. Hey.
Hey. Hi, EB.
Gary, I think one of the last times I really spent time with you, we were hanging out with Alice Cooper and Jimmy Page and Brian May in London.
Yeah, just, you know, regulars who drop by every once in a while.
I'd love to be able to say that. Well, I want to give a little backstory about why we were hanging out with such illustrious rock and roll legends, because you've really worked with so many legends in so many areas. But here's a little backstory. If people were to go on LinkedIn, they would read something, I'm going to tell you, a little jargony. But if you're in the business world, maybe you'd understand it. It says,
are you telling me that you want to edit my LinkedIn site for me?
I do. You know I'm a content marketer.
That's very EB Moss of you.
It says, unique and verifiable experience in transitioning leading entertainment companies and brands from conventional broadcast to digital business models. And you're an entrepreneurial executive with a proven track record in broadcasting, advertising, music, and technology-based businesses. Now, I understand that part. I'm kidding you, Gary, because you deserve to have a very illustrious, you know, professional-sounding background. You've done so much. But, you know, in a nutshell, basically, you have launched the careers, the radio shows of so many people. I'm going to say, drop names, what, like Carson Daly, what else?
Well, to clarify, I didn't do that by myself. I always had, I was either working for a company or part of a team or had people working for me in every single case. In the case of like a Carson Daly, at that point, I was working for Premier Radio Networks, which is the network division of iHeart. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was called Clear Channel. And Carson, at that time, was primarily known as the host of Total Request Live on MTV, but clearly wanted to, whose roots were in radio, and he had a desire to move into the radio space, and we launched his first syndicated show at Premier. Someone else who did a similar path was Ryan Seacrest, whose first radio show was something called Live from the Lounge.
So let's talk a little bit about your path to that, because certainly, you know, you had already established yourself as a successful executive in the radio industry. What was your path to get to that? And let's list some of the companies and what they are known as today.
Okay. Well, I was very fortunate in that very early on, I kind of got the sledgehammer over the head moment while in college of what I wanted to do. And, you know, as a father of three recent college graduates, it's important for, and we all know, to know what they want to do. When I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew that I loved music. I came from a family that operated in the entertainment business. My dad owned restaurants. My older brother, Mark, managed Catch a Rising Star and the Lone Star Cafe. So did my brother, Scott, managed Stand Up New York. And it was always around, you know. Mm-hmm. So I kind of knew I liked music and all that. And then I, at the first school I went to, which was William Patterson College, I walked into the radio station and boom, there it was, right?
Oh, your calling.
Yeah, the calling. And I got very involved. They did a radio show. I just caught the bug. Eventually, I transferred into Emerson College, which was then and still is now a very good school for broadcasting and radio, and got involved with that radio station. That radio station was a real FM station, and it had a big signal, and people from New Hampshire would be calling in. And I found, you know, Boston at that time, which was the early 80s, had great radio stations, WBCN and WCOZ and WEEI, and I interned at a station there. And as well as I did a blues radio show and was the weekend program coordinator for WERS. Ironically, there were some interesting people on the air with me. The guy before me was a guy named Brad Paul, who did a folk show, and he went on to be the head of promotion for Rounder Records. There was a guy behind me named Doug Herzog, who loved reggae. Doug went on with lots of other college pals to start MTV.
Yep, I remember the name.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then there was a guy named Elroy Smith who came in with a box of tapes, carts, and he did like a real radio show. Elroy is now programming the urban stations in San Francisco, but had ran WGCI for many years and others. And Tammy Heidi, who was on the air at KROQ and WBCN. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a potent little scene. But what really got to me immediately was, I don't know what it was. It was a feeling that working at one radio station was very myopic to me, very isolating. In those days, you remember, you didn't have this consolidation.
Right.
You know, one person sometimes owned a radio station, or another company owned another, and it was us against them. Like, if you even talked to somebody from another radio station, that was, you know, sacrilege.
That. Yeah.
And I just didn't like that. And then every week this vinyl disc would come in called the King Biscuit Flower Hour.
Right,
which is a concert series put out by a company called DIR Broadcasting. And it would be a live performance by a really eclectic. This was before real format radio was happening. So you'd get a disc and it would have a live recording of the Allman Brothers from the Fox Theater in Atlanta and opened by, you know, Bruce Springsteen. Like, wow, what is this? This is really cool. And so that was my first taste of syndication, what they called radio syndication. And fortunately, through the miracles of the universe, a family friend had, I found out, was a producer of that show. He was producing another concert series called the Silver Eagle Music Series for country. And he picked up the phone, took out his Rolodex, and he called a few people. One of them was a guy named Josh Feigenbaum, who had recently left there to start MJI. And I believe MJI Broadcasting, and he had a radio show called the Robert Klein Radio Show, which was really ahead of its time. Yeah, it was sort of like Johnny Carson show on the air, and you know, Ringo would come on, and they'd play live in front of a live audience. And so I became the second employee there. didn't get paid for the first couple of months. Thought my father was going to kill me. And long story short, that company, you know, I guess today you would call that a startup. That phrase didn't exist then. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we grew that company over the years to be, you know, one of the largest independent radio networks in the country.
And you left there, by the way, as the VP and general manager.
Right.
So not a bad track record there.
Well, you know, it was very organic. You know, it really was two guys and a coffee cup.
How many years was that?
15 years.
And then you went to, what was AM/FM?
Right. Mm-hmm. So
AM/FM Radio Networks, I should say.
Right. So in 1996, if people remember, it was the beginning of the relaxation of these longstanding ownership rules.
Right. Well, you could have more than...
Right. The Telecommunications Act of 1934, you know, any one company could only own one radio station, AM, one radio station, FM, and a TV station, no more. And no more than 12 AMs or 12 FMs nationally. In 96, under the Clinton administration, that all changed. So that, you know, kicked off what I call the NCA, you know, Final Four race in terms of consolidation. So all these companies started to consolidate. You could own up to, I think, five stations in a market. Mm-hmm. And that change of laws, you know, started the consolidation, resulted in a smaller number of companies, and one of those owning lots of radio stations. And the first real big one was AM/FM, and they owned 100 radio stations. But the stations that they owned were these unbelievable radio brands like Z100 in New York and Kiss 108 in Boston and Kiss in Los Angeles. And the thinking amongst that group was, let's go into the network radio business. So most of that management group was led by a guy named David Cantor, who was the president of ABC at the time. And he put together the first new network launch in something like 20 years. I was lured away from MJI to go start that because it was so exciting. Mm-hmm. And I went over there as a VP of programming. And our job there was, now we had this platform of, say, 60 rock stations, and we had, you know, 70 country stations and all different kinds of stations for the first time. And we began to either develop programming or acquire programming and create AM/FM. So during that time, we bought the rights to American Top 40 with Casey Kasem, which at that time defined top 40 radio. So I had the chance to work with Casey, which was unbelievable. We acquired a company called Global Satellite Network, which had a show called Rockline with Bob Coburn, which was benefited from this new technology called satellite and would interview artists. And everything was clipping along, but, you know, this acquisition phase kept going, and eventually Clear Channel won, and they ended up buying my previous company, MJI Broadcasting, and AM/FM. So now we're all back together again.
Yeah.
And so I was there for at the Clear Channel under Premier Networks, run by a guy named Craig Kitchen, for about 5 years. So that's the AM/FM story.
I appreciate the history from, you know, the single station, maybe the AM and then the FM and then the network and then the bigger network. And now you have KMG.
Yes.
And tell me about the early stage when you built that out in around, what, 2012 and where it is today.
It was actually earlier. It was somewhere between 2009 and 2010. After Premier, and ironically working with people like Carson Daly and Ryan Seacrest, as well as the leaders in conservative political talk, Rush Limbaugh and all that, I oversaw Rush Limbaugh's staff, although it was not my particular brand of politics, but I really have utmost respect for all of those people in those times. I got recruited to be the president of Air America Radio, which was the answer to the conservative talk. And I spent some time there, and we hired Rachel Maddow, and Mark Maron was my morning man, and Al Franken was my afternoon man. Spent some time there, and then I went to Westwood One as chief digital officer at a time when it was
alma mater, but in a different incarnation. Yeah.
And it was really at Westwood that I really saw, you know, that was sort of the apex of where you could be, a publicly traded company, had rights to almost every sports contract for the radio, big entertainment, an archive going back to the late 70s, but a publicly held company, and really the beginnings of what we started to see in terms of the changing of the radio business. And I saw that there was an opportunity again to sort of go back to a more premium kind of network, which what MJI was sort of known for back in the day. But at the time, in other media, you're starting to hear things like, it's not TV, it's HBO, you know, and things like The Sopranos were coming out and Mad Men, and people were just reacting and watching television very differently. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. You know, maybe we could be, KMG could be like that. So made a conscious decision to be sort of a highly creative, highly focused company that specializes only in best in brand or clear market need and high focus. And so that was the first project. It coincided with the 30th anniversary of John Lennon's death. And some people who were who did the last interview with him, which happened to be on December 8th, 1980, did that last interview. And then the famous story is that they left. They actually drove John and Yoko to the hit factory and dropped him off. They got on a plane and he was gone. So that was the last known interview. Wow. And that interview sort of floated around, and they wanted to come back and sort of do like a where were you when kind of recollection. And so we did that. And it was a mind blower for me, because now instead of working at this big company with all these resources and a secretary and people, it was kind of me and my kitchen table.
Sort of like us right now.
And, you know, I had to secure the rights to the interview from Yoko and, you know, all these kinds of things. And it was a hit. It worked. And that's what really, you know, gave me the germ of, you have the right content at the right time, no matter what's going on, people will, you know, the gatekeepers will want it and the listeners will resonate. So that began the company. And so over the years, we continue to identify programs and services that fit that model. You know, is it best in brand or have a clear market need? Are these companies, are these people, these talents really in it for the long haul, or have something to offer? And one of the key components that I knew I could enjoy at my own company rather than others is, do I like them?
Yeah.
You know, do I not get a stomachache Sunday night knowing I'm the call? So that formula has worked pretty well over the years, and we still continue to be an independent. Now, we don't call it syndicator. We call it content creator, which now produces and helps distribute and monetize content in terrestrial radio, satellite radio, streaming,
and what are some podcasts of those properties now? We can actually talk about one, the historical one that I mentioned, the Classic Rock Roll.
Oh, the Classic Rock Awards.
And hence how we were hanging out with Jimmy Pooch.
Yeah, so that was a perfect example of, you know, I think it was a realization of sort of the vision of the company, in that fortunately, because I had worked at many of the companies out there, I still had lots of colleagues and former co-workers inside these companies. And by that time, Clear Channel had become iHeart, and they had gone on to create all these proprietary events, Jingle Ball Tour, the iHeart Music Awards, all these wonderful things. I learned of an award show in the UK that was organized by the publishers of a pretty influential magazine over there called Classic Rock Magazine. Mm-hmm. And a friend said, you can't believe this thing, you know, it's at the Roundhouse in London and there are 100 tables and there's, you know, Roger Daltrey at one, yes, and Mick Jagger. I'm like, no way.
Right.
It can't
right.
be true. And I got on a plane. I went over there with my partner, a guy named Robert Olshever, and it was true.
Yes.
And moreover, they had built their own radio unit and were syndicating programming over there. And as part of their expansion, they wanted to come and do these awards from the United States. And do I think that that could work? And, you know, my gut said yeah. But this was a case where I went to iHeart, and, you know, iHeart owns 70 classic rock stations, mm-hmm, Q104 in New York, among others, and is led by a guy named Eric Wellman, who's what they call a brand manager. And I said, would you be interested in it? And he said, yes. And so they became our radio partner, and we ended up producing a whole range of programming leading up to the event, with a UK-based host by the name of Nicky Horn, who's this legendary broadcaster there. We did a live event in Los Angeles and all that. We went back the second year, and this time a young, intelligent woman by the name of E.B. Moss came into my universe, and we had to go out.
Thank you for the young, by the way.
Yeah, and this time we had to do it from there, and you found a sponsor. You found Gibson Guitars, mm-hmm, which is unbelievable. They never spent money on radio, and we went over there, and we had a backstage.
Yes, we did.
We had first position on the red carpet. We had one-to-one interviews. And Jimmy Page came by.
I will post the photos.
And Brian May came by. And Alice Cooper came by. Rick Wakeman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was interesting because they were in their element and they were hanging with their friends.
That's right.
And it wasn't filled with media like we're used to. So it was so relaxed.
It was almost like, you know how the Golden Globes is the more chill version of the Oscars?
Right.
It was that kind of feel where people were just enjoying themselves.
Enjoying themselves.
And you couldn't believe who you were shoulder rubbing with.
Yeah. Yeah. And our friends at Classic Rock Magazine are our friends of theirs. And, mm-hmm, and our presenter, Nicky Horn, are friends of theirs. So it was all... it was all great. And so so that was a wonderful experience of bringing content that just didn't exist into a company who had all the abilities to be able to accelerate that and was just not in that realm on a national basis.
Right.
They were not producing an event in the classic rock. So they became a very good partner for us.
So I want to bring us, with the remaining minutes that we have, into the present. Because
okay,
you've got yet another incarnation with Utopia.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Okay. So the original vision that I had talked about in terms of being an independent syndicator expanded into advising big media brands. So now what happens? Podcasting, mm-hmm, becomes more than just a basement hobby. You know, I think we're still in it, this incredible expansion of audio entertainment. I quickly realized that in a way we can sort of go back to the future and be extremely creative and find content direct to consumer and partnered with huge talent, huge brands. The funny story too is, so this was about a year and a half ago, because, you know, banging my head against the wall and putting together syndicated network shows, calling, you know, decision making is becoming much more centralized. And it was really difficult. And then at the same time, I was newly single again after being divorced and going out on dates. And they'd say, well, what do you do? And I go, well, I'm in the radio business. And they go, radio? Is that that still work. And then, but I then quickly learned if I said, well, I have a podcast studio. Oh, really? I have one too. Can I have your number? But you know, it was very similar in, you know, the who ever thought that we'd have an audio entertainment explosion. We would never think right. that would happen. So I quickly realized that many of the disciplines I was bringing to terrestrial network radio applied. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to create KMG Utopia Studios. Utopia is the parkway, is the street I grew up in Queens. Okay. And I said, same thing, different kind of filter here. You know, I don't know what the number is. You probably know better. 800,000 podcasts.
874,000 podcasts right now, I think.
And at once, it's the greatest thing in the world. You can innovate everything. We had to unlearn everything we knew about being, you know, within format and playing the right song right. and, you know, talking too much and all this. And we could be free. The downside is that how do you get people to know about it and, you know, create enough value where an advertiser could spend some money on it? And I quickly came to the conclusion that you can identify categories and certain talent that already have a huge following right. in a particular vertical.
Yep. So now with the utopia of podcasting, which I believe it is right now, a great utopian environment.
I like that. Can I use that?
You can, instead of the street you grew up on.
Thank you.
Okay. I thought that's what you meant, by the way. So you have, five or six different podcasts that are either established or launching?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we launched the first one, which is called The Fred Minnick Show. And Fred is the foremost bourbon critic in the country.
I like him already.
Yeah, and he's well known in the bourbon lifestyle circles as the editor of, as the bourbon critic for Wall Street Journal and Forbes. He's written 7 books. He's has a Amazon Prime show, and he co-curates the big bourbon festivals in Louisville. So he's got a built-in audience and a built-in advertiser base.
And I think what he does, I looked at the description, he basically drinks bourbon and interviews like
he's a passionate music lover and is as well. So he brings the artist in, he talks about their songs, and then he asks them very specific questions to match their palate to a bourbon. And then they literally throw the bottle to him from off camera, and they began to sip. I would say 9 times out of 10, he's dead on. Artists, so he's done this with Lindsay L. He's done this with Ray Lynn Nelson. He's done this with a number of different people. And they relax, and then they start sipping the bourbon.
I didn't get
and then the
you
fun
any.
Begins.
I give you water, Gary. I'm sorry.
So it's a very unique, again, you know, today, I think, you know, the idea of anybody sitting down with any artist as an interview 5 years ago would be cool enough. Mm-hmm. I think today, because of the plethora of content out there, you have to have a unique take on it.
Yeah.
And this is our unique take on it.
Yeah, good one. And so what are some of the others in a nutshell?
The second one we're very excited about is the first in a series of podcasts with Politicon, which is the Comic-Con of politics.
That's a great description.
Which is a brand that's now in its
sixth... Because politics is kind of hysterical
it
right
sure
now.
It sure is. They're in their 6th year as a brand. They've built a huge live destination event annual where media personalities in the political realm come in and mash it up and debate and do town halls, and tens of thousands of people pay money to come and see it dressed up as Baby Trump and Hillary Clinton and Abraham Lincoln, et cetera. But we together, our companies got together to really build media brands for Politicon. And the first one is one hosted by, drumroll please, Clay Aiken.
Wow.
who many people don't know is very well known in political circles. Since American Idol, he ran for office in his home state and almost won. And so he will host a bipartisan panel of folks who will mash it up in front of a live audience mm-hmm. each week.
Tell me about some of the challenges in podcasting today.
Well, I think the biggest one is awareness. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, the old way, if you're dealing with terrestrial or old media, if you will, what's the frustration? It's getting the gatekeepers to buy into it before it gets the consumer. However, if you're trying to do a deal with iHeartRadio for a minute, they say yes, that audience is going to be there to support it. In this case, you do have the freedom, the utopian freedom, mm-hmm. to create anything you want. But if nobody's listening, it doesn't matter.
In terms of the sponsorship sell.
Right. In order to get the sponsorship sell, you need to have the listeners. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's a transactional discussion, which is tried and true metrics. How many... Mm-hmm. downloads do you get, and mm-hmm. The amount of commercials you have in a podcast and all that. And then, there's sort of an irrational exuberance going on today about brands just wanting to be associated, and mm-hmm. it's not based on any metrics.
Right.
It's just based on a feeling or a desire to get into the space. I think the challenge long term will be really coming up with solid media brands that will go past the irrational exuberance mm-hmm. and achieve the audience and reach the listeners that need to be reached and continue to be attracted to advertisers.
Right. Now, with all due respect, anyone who wants to sponsor Insider Interviews with E.B. Moss with our, let's say, somewhat limited audience right now, would still be welcome. But and I say that in a kidding way.
Yeah, no, I would say
this is very targeted.
If
this is
I was
a
sponsor that
one.
Wanted to reach, high level executives with a curious minds,
yep.
and a yearning to learn and network with others, this would be a great place for a sponsorship.
Right.
And I think therein lies the opportunity too. A lot of talk is about, you're hearing the term big podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're seeing Hollywood studios get involved. You're seeing huge stars coming into it. I think that's their place. And I think but I also think there's a place for, really unique, highly targeted podcast as well.
Yeah.
But one thing that's consistent out of all of them, and this is a high compliment to you, you are well-researched, you are disciplined, you are passionate. That is what's going to carry you through. Many of these 800,000 podcasts are out there. They don't mm-hmm. keep going because... it's tough work. It's
yeah.
not just opening the mic and talking with your friends.
Right.
So I think that, if we stay disciplined and pick the hits, everything is about picking the hits. That's, the challenge. My friend Danny Goldberg wrote a book called Bumping at the Geniuses, which I love. And he got that from, asking Ahmet Erdogan what his secret to success was. He says, I bump into geniuses. I think that's a great analogy,
yeah.
It's try to find that genius.
Yeah.
And then build off of that.
I love it. And I think that's the perfect place to end, Gary, because this was a genius conversation. I loved hearing the history of not only your path to, being a senior executive in the audio space, but the evolution of audio itself. And, I do have to say that radio certainly still experiences, 90% of the U.S. population is still...
93.
Uh-huh. So 93% of the U.S. population still listens to radio on a daily basis. But podcasting is a little bit more flexible, a little bit more... targeted in listener interests in many respects. You talk about, a bourbon and music podcast or a business-to-business podcast like this. So there really is something for everyone. And I love that you're applying the lessons that you learned from radio to podcasting and, whether you call it content or syndication or what have you, it's still current and it's still applicable today. So
I hope so.
Yeah.
I know so.
You're already making a utopian podcast network, so it's great.
There you go.
Gary Kranz, thank you so much for being my first guest.
Thank you for having me, Evie.
Insider Interviews.
Thank you.
I hope you got some good inside scoop from this episode, and I hope that you'll continue to get more by subscribing to Apple, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts. And I want to thank you for listening. I also want to thank our editor, Eric Klein, and my good friend, John Clayton, for the amazing theme music for Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss.